Hello, and thank you for joining us for this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast. This podcast is presented in conjunction with our new virtual exhibit, American Voices, which you can explore at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of Americo Paredes. Paredes was an esteemed scholar and storyteller of the Mexico-U.S. border, a champion of its history, peoples, music, and mythologies. He grew up in Brownsville, Texas, in the borderlands along the Rio Grande, giving him a deep understanding of how, as he said, two cultures mingled and clashed. He wrote in both Spanish and English, and in some poems, mixing the two. Paredes was the co-founder and first director of the Mexican-American Studies Department at the University of Texas, Austin. He also helped create a center for folklore at the university. Today we are joined by scholar Jose Ilamon and writer Oscar Caceres. Please check out Jose and Oscar's impressive bios in our show notes for further details. Today, our guests are interviewed by Nate King, Content and Communications Coordinator for the American Writers Museum.
What I'd like to start off with is just tell me a little bit about yourselves and how you first encountered Americo Paredes's work.
Maybe we can start off by me doing something perhaps unfair, which is to prompt Oscar first, in the sense of he grew up in Brownsville, and that's Americo Paredes's hometown. And I've always been curious, Oscar, myself, as to how much did you know about him while you were growing up in Brownsville?
I knew next to nothing about him, and I had the experience that I think many Mexican American kids have in Brownsville and up and down the border to some extent, which is that you only learn about your people, about your history, once you leave and arrive in Austin, Texas. And then you're educated on all the things that the teachers either knew or didn't know or were kept from talking about in public schools. And so, you know, I had heard bits and pieces about him, but really, I did not have a in any way, shape, or form a literary background when I was growing up in Brownsville, or when I left Brownsville, and when I went to UT as an undergrad, it was as an advertising major. And I did that for about 10 years. And it was only when I jumped ship and decided that I was going to write and began to explore that Paredes' name started coming up more and more and more. And then it was undeniable that I was going to have to pursue that path and investigate what he had done, obviously, that it wasn't going to be something sort of on the periphery of my knowledge, but it was going to take center stage. I must have started reading him, and now we're talking about the already into the late 90s. Right. And I'm at this point in my mid 30s, 36 thereabouts. And so I quit advertising. And one of the things that I started doing was auditing classes at UT. And so I would show up at different professors' offices or in the class itself and then beg them to if I could sit in on their class. And one of the classes I took, it was a bit delayed compared to the other students I had been talking about a minute ago. But I went through that process of going to a Mexican American history class. And it was Ricardo Romo's class. And I asked him if I could sit in on his class. And he was gracious enough to let me take a spot in the back of the room. And we covered a vast amount of different parts of culture and history and such. And then at the end of the course, the last week or so, we read George Washington Gomez. And by this time I had become, I had everything that Paredes had written, everything I could get my hands on anyway. And he came to the class. This must have been 97, maybe 98. And he was pretty frail at that point. Had to sit most of the class to give his brief remarks. And then Romo invited the students to come down and get their books signed with them. Well, most of the students were just sort of like, you know, it was just this guy they brought in. They didn't really kind of, you know, three or four came down and had the book signed. And then I lingered till the riffraff got out of the way, because I had a stack of about five books. And at that point, you know, Paredes was ready to just go home and take a nap or do whatever. He'd already exhausted himself. And then he had to open up one book after another book and hear me tell him that I had this dream of becoming a writer. Of course, this dream had only started, you know, whatever, 9 months earlier, but it had, you know, I was all in at that point. But it was, I was thinking about this morning, though I had not grown up conscious of his work, and had not come to my, you know, real attention until much later, I had been around so many of these stories growing up. And so when I was reading With a Pistol in His Hand or George Washington Gomez, and then later the Texas Mexican cancionero, this was all sort of coming back to me, in the sense that I had heard these stories from my tios growing up. These were all the sort of lived experiences that, you know, I had this sort of ongoing conflict in my family where my tio had held on to all these stories. He was born in 1924. My father had been born in 1914, a year before Paredes. And so my tio, because he was the youngest in the family, had just collected all these stories from my grandfather, who had been born in the late 1800s, right? And he just had stories and stories and stories and stories about the Texas Rangers and stories about how we had arrived in Texas and these legends. And my father thought his brother was crazy, you know, and he's, oh, your tio's loco. Don't pay attention to him. He doesn't know what he's talking about. And so I grew up with this tension between this narrative that he has for me that sounds incredible. I mean, it's just coming to life in our living room every time he visits. And my father telling me not to pay attention to him, and not knowing how much of it is legend and just made up, embellished, and how much of it is actual history. And it's only when I pick up Paredes's work that I realize, damn, this is not only based on fact. This is the legitimate thing, and I've been listening to it in bits and pieces, you know, not through books, but through the oral tradition, essentially, which is, you know, so much of what is driving Paredes, it seems, at the beginning. And certainly, you know, is used as the epigraph for in The Pistol with His Hand.
Maybe I can jump in here, Nate, and take off on what Oscar just said about how the stories are so close to his lived reality, his lived experience, because both writers, that is to say, Paredes and my dear friend Oscar, you know, work within a code of realism in terms of their representation of everyday life, either in the Brownsville of the 1930s or in the Brownsville of the 1970s through the 80s and 90s that Oscar writes about. So I would suggest to you that, you know, it's a very interesting thing that even before Oscar knew of Paredes's writing, I think he was already ready to write again in that very realistic mode, which is another way of saying is that neither writer takes off on flights of modernist fancy. You know, they adhere really close to lived experience, to ordinary speech, and their presence in the present situation. And both writers are always quite mindful of the larger forces that are operating around around Brownsville in both cases.
Yeah. What sort of grounding in reality like that? How do you think that affects the stories that are told or the way they're told?
Well, I mean, I think to a certain degree, there's a documenting that we're doing. Certainly with, you know, with a pistol in his hand, it is a correcting, an amending of history. And it's a heroic deed in the sense of the mythology that is that makes up the state of Texas. I mean, makes not only the country and how we see ourselves as Americans, but as Texans. And to go up against those forces was, unbelievable. I mean, part of what had always, part of what I'd love to hear from Jose about was that intrigued me about Paredes and my that experience of having him sign that the stack of books was my one and only encounter with him. But you know, I was fascinated early on hearing about his start in journalism and such, which you hear that with writers. But having grown up in Brownsville in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and it's a border community. It's at the southernmost tip of the state. It's where the Rio Grande ends and eventually flows into the Gulf of Mexico, and it's a very fairly remote area in many respects, and to think of this young man Paredes reading poetry on the radio seemed like the most radical thing. It wouldn't happen today. I cannot imagine it happening in the 30s. It's just the top of my head just blows up when I think about that concept.
Well, let me amplify that a bit, because Paredes also was a member of a circle of poets in Brownsville. Now, that also can blow you away. The idea five or six guys would go to a bar and do the unbar-like thing of reading poetry in Matamoros is amazing. I mean, Oscar is right. That wouldn't happen in any culture today. I mean, right? Who does poetry in a bar anymore, right?
Yeah.
You mentioned with a pistol in his hand and how it's kind of a retelling of that story. I mean, now's a good time to go into that. What sort of was the myth at the time and the circumstances around that myth that he kind of reshaped, and kind of, from what my understanding is, it's kind of like there was this other side to the story too that no one's talking about.
Well, maybe I can take advantage of that to also again amplify what Oscar was saying in another direction, and that is, along with all the other characteristics of Brownsville, it is hugely predominantly people of Mexican origin. This is why particularly in his short stories, I'll get around to with his pistol in hand in a second, but in his short stories, particularly in the collection called The Hammond and the Beans and other stories, the people that populate those stories are all Mexican-Americans. There is, I think, one Anglo to be found in all of the collection. And I was, when I read Oscar's work, his collection of short stories, same thing happened. You know, there is one Anglo who borrows a hammer.
I didn't want to be accused of, you know.
But that's almost, if you're going to be true to life, as I think both writers were, that's what you have to represent. Now, if only in that respect, both Paredes and Oscar are really, really unusual, because so much of Mexican-American writing has posited ethno-racial conflict, right? You know, between Anglos and Mexicans. And these two guys, at least in those collections, and even in Oscar's novel, Amigo Land, you enter almost a 100% Mexican-American world. Now, what does that have to do with his pistol in his hand? Well, recall that the protagonist of the balladry and of the book, Gregorio Cortez, is originally from somewhere around Brownsville. It's never specified where exactly he's from. But the story cannot appear until he has left Brownsville. It kind of reminds me of what Oscar said earlier. You learn about stuff once you leave the border and go to UT Austin. Well, in Gregorio Cortez's case, he learned the harder lessons of life by leaving the border and going up to the area not far from Austin. When the conflict opens, he's not in Brownsville. He's not on the border. He's not even in South Texas. You know, he's already in Central Texas, which historically is the meeting ground between Anglos and Mexicans in Texas. And so the story almost has to begin there. And of course it unfolds when the shooting occurs with the sheriff and so forth. And of course the first thing he does is, you know, is make for the border. In that particular case though, he's going towards Laredo, you know, not to Brownsville. It's never been clear to anyone, including Paredes himself, because I asked that question as to why Laredo? Why does Cortez, you know, when the shorter route might have been along the Gulf Coast, you know, down to Brownsville itself or some other place. And that story, that's always been a source of mystery as to why Gregorio Cortez did that once having shot the sheriff. And as to paraphrase Bob Marley, and he didn't get the deputy, you know. So Paredes' public career begins actually with a story with his pistol in his hand that is actually has its beginnings not in Brownsville, not in South Texas, but in Central Texas, and then takes it back to the border. It's only later, of course, with the discovery of his manuscripts that we learn about the earlier Paredes. Substantially. So, and that brings up a whole other question about, because so in one of the questions you sent us, you raised questions of influence and who influences who and so forth, you know. Again, to take Oscar as an example, I'm wondering what might have happened if, for example, this book, The Hammond and the Beans, had appeared in print as Oscar is growing up. So, and he reads this, he won't be able to read this until much, much later, you know, because for the most part, the stories were unpublished. So Paredes is in an interesting situation where he comes late to us as a writer. Now, as a folklorist, of course, the big appearance is with his pistol in his hand in 1958. But even a part of that book in the chapter called The Legend is really a short story in many ways.
Reminds me of an interesting point, or something that I found impressive, is the many different styles he wrote in, or genres even. You know, there's poetry, as we mentioned, talked about earlier, as a folklorist, and then later as novelist, short story. But as you know, as you're saying, he was kind of doing all that at the same time, just wasn't necessarily public. And even, you know, I read that he was also a singer, you know, a songwriter too. So
I'll add to that, Nate, and say that one of the things that jumped out at me, and I had not read all that much, I mean in general had not written all that much, because it was so early into into writing. And as I mentioned, or may have mentioned, I had grown up essentially in a house with no books. So when I started, it was only when I started writing that I started reading. But even so, my limited experience, when I was reading George Washington Gomez, one of the things that immediately stood out to me, and that I, when I think of the book, one of the things that immediately comes back to me is almost this genre shifting that happens from fiction to what feels at times like an essay, where there'll be passages where he talks about the history of, as he calls it, as a Jonesville on the border, and it's a very thinly disguised Brownsville. He's basically just, you know, rearranging it slightly, but there are passages in there where he talks about politics along the border, where he talks about the history of the Rangers, this vigilante way of justice that they were going about, just rounding up Mexicans without any jury, without any proof, without whatever, the lynchings that were going on. And then suddenly he'll shift back into the narrative of to the fictional voice. And I was just so impressed that somebody could do that, you know. And you don't usually, when someone is writing fiction, they stay in their lane. they do not cry. I mean, or if they do, it's kind of a little awkward, but they find a way of sort of including a detail or two. No, he goes right at it. And so that's part of the joy for me in this book was getting both the fictional experience and the nonfiction happening, you know, simultaneously.
It's interesting that Oscar is noting that, because that from certain quarters, that's actually been a problem for Professor Paredes.
Yeah.
In the sense that it is precisely that feature that some critics have held against him, that this is a flawed novel.
Mm.
Because of the intervention of those long passages where, as Oscar says, you feel like you're reading history or an essay.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, and there's so many ways of sort of drawing out from George Washington Gomez, and even with a pistol in his hand, but the manner in which in the Faulkner line that gets peddled so much, of the history not being passed, right, of it being very contemporary. And in that sense, I mean, to me, you know, at least, you know, when I go back to it, and when I look at the those passages, they feel so very important in the, and I think it would be less of a novel without them, you know, whether the critics find it, you know, a little jarring or whatever, I think it's a sort of a cornerstone to this narrative.
Yeah, I agree with that. And the book, you know, I mean, you have to recall, I mean, the man starts writing this thing when he's a high school senior.
Yeah.
And finishes it in chunks and pieces. So it has its problems, problems of character, some character development sometimes. We don't get a lot of deep introspection into the characters. Except, of course, for the protagonist, George Washington Gomez himself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Where again, by the way, you know, notice how the plot of this book can really develop only after George Washington Gomez leaves.
Mm-hmm. The valley.
And where does he go? To the University of Texas at Austin, you know.
Where else?
Yeah. Except unlike Oscar and myself, because I arrived there in 1964. You know, he, George Washington Gomez, the fictional character, arrives there at an earlier moment. where it's not the nurturing place that it's becoming later, you know, such that young people like Oscar can learn about the valley away from the valley. When I got there in 1964, I was there almost 4 years, actually, as an undergraduate and then a graduate student before I met Paredes. Again, it's a version of what Oscar was describing about not knowing anything about him in Brownsville. Well, even at UT, and even I think it's probably true to this day, it's possible for a Mexican-American student to arrive at UT, graduate, and never know anything about Américo Paredes. You know, less likely today, but still possible. But when I got there in 64, I didn't get to know him. I didn't even know he existed, frankly, until about 1967. And the only reason that I got to know him has everything to do with ethnic and racial conflict at that moment, including on the University of Texas campus. Professor Paredes was looking for a grader assistant, somebody to help him do his greatest papers. And the English department accepted applications, and they had a long list of grad students who were looking for that kind of work. Okay. And Professor Paredes later told me the story that he simply went to the list. Okay. He went down the list until he came to the first Spanish surname. And that was me.
Easy enough.
Yeah. And that's how I got to meet him. I mean, simply, now, why is he doing that?
Lucky there wasn't a Jimenez before you or something.
Yeah. There was no Gomez Garcia Casares before me.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I wouldn't have gotten the job, you know.
But, well, it's funny because I'm thinking now, you know, my parents had me really late in life. And so I had three siblings by the time I was born. But my second oldest brother must have arrived at UT around the same time that you were there, Jose. And he tells me, you know, that they had their little apartment that they rented, and it was just three or four Mexican students from the valley. They had their place where they went and they got their hair cut. I mean, he sort of, you know, paints this picture of how they stuck together as a group. And he came up to Austin, you know, several years ago when I got the tenure. And, you know, the Center for Mexican American Studies had a little ceremony for us, a little dinner and such. And afterwards, I thanked him for flying up from the valley for the event. It was a small event, but it was nice that he had made the effort. And he says, I remember him telling me, he says, when I was a student, there weren't very many of us here, but we knew that there was one professor. We knew that there was somebody from Brownsville here, and that he was a professor, and that meant something. In that sense of representation, of being there, of having established it, himself and having a name, whether my brother knew, I mean, my brother was in the business school, so he didn't cross paths with Paredes directly, but, you know, he knew of him. My father tells the story, I'm hearing these stories when my father was in his 80s and 90s, but he actually, when he got shipped off to World War II, that he and Paredes were on the same bus, and that Paredes at this time, and this is the part, you know, I don't know about the chronology, but that Paredes, that his marriage with Chelo Silva had already fallen apart, and that was part of the chisme on the bus. That Paredes was sitting alone, and all these other guys were in the back of the bus, and of course he was known because he was on the radio, and of course she was very well known.
Nate, I don't know if you picked up the reference to Chelo Silva. She was a very famous singer, Mr. Paredes' first wife. after he arrives in Japan with the occupation army, it's only later, and I think it's 1946, that they actually finally get divorced. But as Oscar says, their marriage was already becoming unraveled, and no doubt that probably played a part in why he chose to enlist rather late in the war, because he was actually deferred. He had a a work deferment because he was working at Pan American Airways, which used to have some sort of a station there in Brownsville. I never figured out exactly what he did, but he was working for Pan American and had a draft deferment, but chose to join up because he was feeling guilty about so many young men leaving the valley and a lot of them not coming back. But by the time he joins, the war is effectively coming to an end, which is why he spends most of his army tour as in the Army of Occupation in Japan, where he will meet his second wife, Amelia.
And from what I understand, he also was writing for the army too, right? Like they, what's it, Stars and Stripes, I think. Yeah.
This collection, again, The Hammond and the Beast, approximately one third of the stories in this collection are actually set in Japan. They have Japanese characters, Japanese background, etc.
I wanted to go back to Oscar. You were saying how when your brother went to University of Texas, just knowing that one person from Brownsville was there, I don't know if you could expand on that. What does that sort of representation mean to you now, and then also, at the time, Paredes really seems to be he even mentioned it earlier, radical and sort of really forward thinking and ahead of his time in some way.
Radical, groundbreaking. I mean, just clearing a path. When I read just the opening passages of with a pistol in his hand, I mean, he's not pulling any punches. There's a grace, but an indignation mixed in with it that he's just going to call it as he sees it, and he's going to call out certain people who have been part of this myth building or continuing the myth building of the role that the Texas Rangers had played in this lore of the Texas Rangers sort of in popular culture, the way they were mythologized was radically different to the real life experience on the ground in South Texas. It was night and day. And so, for somebody to come out, with his own pistol in his hand, I thought was just so, in South Texas anyway, and maybe it's because I grew up with a father who very much was like this, very outspoken, and just sort of told you as it was. Some people took offense to it. In my father's mind, they were not insults to say what was what. He classified them as claridades. Clarity. He's getting the dust and the smog and whatever out of the way so that you can open your eyes and see what is what. And so much of With a Pistol in His Hand are claridades. I mean, it's nothing but the reality of what was. And what was, the interesting thing is that, the worst of what had happened with regard to the Rangers had taken place or was coming to an end as Paredes was born, right? They get kicked out of South Texas, essentially, or disbanded in 1919. He's born in
1915.
So what is essentially happening is he's received that oral tradition, that idea that the you know, that epigraph of to all those old men who sat around on summer nights in the days when there was a chaparral, smoking their corn husk cigarettes and talking in low, gentle voices about violent things while I listened. That, you know, that gift and the what he had heard and, you know, internalized and knew to be true and was still living around the descendants of those, you know, the family members, the descendants of those lynchings, were still very much alive and present. But it's not happening as he's necessarily a young man or whatever. I mean, it's still around to some degree, but it's not what it was prior to that.
Just to stress Oscar's point about the Texas Rangers, about what happened when the book got published. The book appears in 1958 with his pistol in his hand. Does. In 1959, you know, after the book had circulated a bit, the story goes, and it's been verified a couple of times, that a Texas Ranger, a real live, you know, red-blooded Texas Ranger, walked into the offices of the University of Texas Press and went up to the secretary or somebody holding with his pistol in his hand, in his own hand, and quote, he wanted the address of the son of a bitch who wrote this book.
Yikes.
Of course, they didn't give it to him, but yeah.
What do you think about that? You know, that book in particular, his writing in general, upsets the Rangers so much, or the myth builders, as you mentioned, Oscar.
Well, I mean, you know, the thing I find fascinating about it is that we're still dealing with this to some degree in a different context. If you've kept up with the dust up that happened a few weeks ago, there's a book that was published a while back called "Forget the Alamo," and it was scheduled for a Zoom discussion, right? I mean, it wasn't going to be like this tremendous turnout. It was, you know. And it was going to be held at the Bob Bullock Museum, which is the state museum here. The powers to be at the Capitol got wind of it and pulled the plug like within 24 hours of it happening. And of course, you know, as is the case with things like that, they end up drawing more attention to it, right? And the whole Forget the Alamo, the book itself, and I've not read it, but from everything I've read about it, isn't necessarily revealing anything that anyone who knows anything about the history of the state and particularly that incident didn't already know of how it doesn't neatly fall into the narrative that of the mythology of Texas. Of how the bad Mexicans came and this massacre and it's a much more complicated, nuanced storytelling of this conflict and what was happening in the state and who had arrived in the state and what the agenda was and how slavery played a major role in it. And then, of course, you know, you're half a step away from you know, discussions of critical race theory and things like that. Do you tell the complete story? Or do you tell the convenient version of the story? And so, you know, I think that was part of what was happening with a pistol in his hand. It was the more complete version of that story.
The ballad, I mean, there is, of course, Paredes is running account of what's going on, but the ballad itself, the balladry itself, also demythologizes the Rangers and represents them for what in fact they were, you know, just mercenaries, you know, wanton violence. And so Paredes, you know, is a student of not only to narrate that story, but also to show us the ballots. I mean, just to collect the ballots in itself, you know, a formidable achievement. Otherwise, they would have been lost, you know, forever. So,
yeah, that brings me to me makes you think of another question I had, which was, you know, if he were alive today and, you know, still actively working, what, how do you think he'd be engaging with our world?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I was just in Brownsville about 2 weeks ago, and boy, I'm gonna have to come up with another name for it now. I mean, part of what's happening, I mean, there's so many things that have happened since his passing. That some that were already in the works. One, which is the militarization of the region, you know, in part because of the border wall. I think that alone, as the top of my head would have almost blown up, the top of his head would have, you know, exploded a couple of times, thinking about the sealing off of the two countries and what that has created. The real life danger of traveling into certain parts of northern Mexico, crossing the border into certain parts, I think is also a huge change that was always there to some degree, but nothing like it has been in the last maybe 10 to 15 years. And then the most recent with regard in particular to Brownsville is the arrival of Elon Musk and his mini NASA. There are two roads that take you out to the coast if you're in Brownsville. One takes you to South Padre Island, which is the kind of a, you know, hotels and restaurants and, you know, a very nice and at certain points kind of overdeveloped area. And then you've got and South Padre Island goes on for, I don't know, 4 or 5 miles in, you know, either direction, and then ends. There's a jetties, and then there's a ship channel. And on the other side of the ship channel is the continuation of the coastline. And that becomes, you know, essentially the poor man's beach, where my family and I would go when I was growing up, and it's called Boca Chica. And Boca Chica goes for another 3 or 4 miles and then ends at the mouth of the river. And then another 300-400 feet and you're in Mexico. And at times that crossing can be 3 or 4 feet in depth, and sometimes a little bit more. But it's that road to the public beach where Musk has built his compound, his you know, and it's driven property real estate prices through the roof. Restaurants are popping up all over town, and it's changing the community in you know, profound and in subtle ways. And, you know, I everyone's kind of not sure what to make of it.
Yeah. Let me offer an observation and taking advantage again of this really nice ethnography that Oscar just laid out of the changes. Professor Paredes, you know, I mean, he obviously, and we've been talking about this, very well known for his pro-Mexican-American, anti-Texas Ranger, and in some ways anti-Anglo-American culture at it in its racist form anyway. You know, that's how his reputation has been largely established, with his pistol in his hand being the central text, of course. But I've suggested for years that embedded in that is also Américo Paredes as a kind of an anti-modernization figure. Everything that Oscar just described, I'm sure would absolutely appall him. and that's probably a very gentle word, you know.
Yeah.
Because And here he becomes like the people he's talking about in Gregorio Cortez, you know, people of the earth, when the valley was, you know, still a self-contained community, as he says, before they chopped down the chaparral, the brush, in order to allow agribusiness to come in. That's really when everything that Oscar just described begins with that.
Well, when they only heard about this afterward, but when they take his ashes to the mouth of the river,
yes,
they drove by Elon Musk's compound.
Yeah, unfortunately. I think he always had that streak in him that he just was very suspicious of the modern, of modernity. Not modernism in a literary sense, but of modernity. I think he would be appalled at what's happened to Austin, you know, just in the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. You know, never mind the politics. See, but it was a mature man already when there was a kind of a democratic moment in Texas politics, democratic with a big D, and that the time when Ann Richards becomes governor, for example. I don't think any of us would have predicted that what has happened in Texas now was going to happen after that time. And I think that also would appall him.
I did want to talk a little bit about corridos themselves, and kind of that sort of writing. I don't know if you would call it a style or a genre, but kind of what that, the importance of those, both in, you know, to Paredes himself, but also to history, kind of, you know, documenting history and passing it on, as you said, you know, with you know, to your family, to whoever wants to listen. I don't know if either of you would like to talk a little bit about those as a, you know, writing genre.
Let me begin. Maybe Oscar can help me along here, because, you know, one of the things people conventionally say about corridos is that they record historical events like Gregorio Cortez, okay, and of course always allowing for some degree of fictionalization and embellishment, but nevertheless the history is there at its core. We know that there was a man named Gregorio Cortez. We know that he got shot, you know, or shot it out rather with the Rangers in 1901, and then we know that he took off for the border. And then on top of that, then there is some embellishment about how, just exactly how many Rangers he killed, how good looking he was, et cetera. But in talking about how good looking he was and the embellishments of things, you know, that's where you enter the aesthetic literary realm. So one of the things I used to stress when I was teaching to students is, yes, there is that the historical content, so to speak, but notice how these people who were not even in high school graduates, you know, back in the 19th century, these, and mostly men who were cowboys, vaqueros, for the most part, right? Notice how they're able to inherit a tradition going all the way back to medieval Spain. You don't compose a corrido of just of random verses or whatever comes to your head. There is an ABCB rhyme scheme that you must follow, okay? The corrido must be written, must be composed in quatrains, four-line stanzas, right? And it also has to produce some degree of plot and rising emotion and conflict, right? All the stuff we associate with literature. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that from the beginning of the settlement of the Lower Rio Grande Valley in the 18th century, there were people there who were literary people, you know, who were artists, who knew how to work with literary conventions. See? And I always point this out to the students, even more so than the conflict and the historical things, you know, because, you know, all of us are always prone to want to go there, right? And not to worry so much about the ABCBs. And I would tell my students, the ABCB is important in and of itself. It gives you a sense of order, especially when you're living in a situation where there's all kinds of disorder coming at you from the Rangers and from, you know, forget the representation, think about the versification.
See? Order and continuity. Continuity in the sense of how the tradition is carried on, how that is, you know, that you don't break that, you honor that. I mean, one of my favorite things about a corrido, and this is maybe broader, because I'm guessing that they maybe don't all end this way, but the despedida of the corrido, which is basically, and now we must go. And we will leave you with this, you know, that idea. That's just good manners. Now I'm leaving. Now I am giving you my farewell. But it's there's just something. Even if they're talking about vaqueros and they're talking about the chaparral, there's just something so elegant about that. I used to bring in. Corridos, when I was talking, I was teaching a class that Jose helped me develop the border narratives. And one of the things I, to sort of help students get their heads around it a bit more, and partly because I was fascinated with its use in modern day media, was, there is an episode in Breaking Bad where they use a corrido. The Walter White character has now gained some prominence in the underworld, right? And the episode starts off with this corrido, but it's never introduced. It's never talked about. You don't know if it's real or imagined or whatever it might be, but it talks about this legendary underworld. I mean, it's not a corrido, it's a narco corrido, essentially, you know. But the interesting backstory to the development of that was that apparently the script writers in LA had conceived of this, had written the thing, had it, you know, translated, and then taken it, contacted somebody in Mexico who had produced corridos, narco corridos, and had them look at it to help them produce it. And that producer said, there's only one problem here. And they're like, well, what's the problem? He says, well, in your version, as you've written this corrido, the Walter White character, the Heisenberg character, wins. And in our version, the cartel never loses. And so they had to rewrite it so that the cartel would come out on top. But that was just the way it happens.
Yeah. Wow.
Unfortunately, that's become now the definitive of the corrido. They're all narco corridos now, for the most part.
Yeah.
Narcotics trade. So.
Did either of you have any passages you wanted to read? And then any sort of lines of Paredes's from any of his work that have always stuck with you, or that you find to be especially powerful?
Oscar, do you want to go first, or shall I?
Yeah, sure. This is a passage from George Washington Gomez. It's I believe chapter 3, and to some degree, I mean, I think there are longer passages that get into the feeling of an essay, but this one was one of the first ones that jumped out at me, because it's still maybe a third of the way through the novel. And the passage is talking about I believe a school teacher and how the students are addressed and just the sort of dynamics of the classroom, and it's this little mini essay about the word Mexican. The word Mexican had for so long been a symbol of hatred and loathing that to most Anglo-Americans, to Anglo-Texans, it had become a hateful and loathsome word. A kindly Anglo hesitated to call a friendly Mexican a Mexican for fear of offending him. Even the Mexico Texan stumbled on the word when he said it in English. In Spanish, Mexicano had a full and prideful sound. The mouth opens on the full vowels and the voice acquires a certain dignity in saying Mexicano. But in English, it is much different. The lower lip pushes up and the upper lip curls contemptuously. The pursed lip goes, Then they part with a smacking, barking sound, Mexican. Who doesn't understand will think he's being cursed at. It is also a word that can be pronounced without opening your mouth at all through clenched teeth. So the kindly Anglo-American uses Latin American to avoid giving offense. And you know, that was one of those experiences that I had grown up and you still hear with, you know, probably less so now, but if, you know, you're talking an older group, they wouldn't say Latin American, they'd say Spanish. Yeah. Well, he's Spanish, you know, and that was code for he's Mexican, but we don't want to call him a Mexican, even if that's what he is, you know, and this dancing around it. And I just found that I was like, oh my God, I've lived that. I've heard that. I've been in those conversations.
Yeah. Mexican.
Mexican. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I was talking earlier about Professor Paredes's quarrel with modernity as opposed to just a quarrel with white America. And this passage speaks to that, but he's talking about Gregorio Cortez and describing Gregorio Cortez in the form of a legend that he Paredes has written out, even though the assumption is this is pretty much the way people ordinarily spoke of Gregorio Cortez back in those times. Okay? And so on the occasion of when Professor Paredes passed away, there was a memorial service held at the University of Texas in Austin, as one would expect, right? And those of us who were invited to speak were asked to read something, or you know, besides saying the usual things about the person, we were also asked to read, much like you asked us today, to read something from his work. And I chose this because it speaks about this question of modernity, about the question of heroes. And I also chose it because for me, it spoke of Américo Paredes himself as a figure, as a mentor figure to me. Okay? And the passage goes like this. For Gregorio Cortez was not of your noisy, hell-raising type. That was not his way. He always spoke low, and he was always polite, whoever he was speaking to. And when he spoke to men older than himself, he took off his hat and held it over his heart. A man who never raised his voice to parent or elder brother and never disobeyed. That was Gregorio Cortez. And that was the way men were in this country along the river. That was the way they were before these modern times came and God went away.
Wow, that was great.
Yeah. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it just, you know, it takes me back to, you know, so many of those customs that I try to, you know, pass along to my children, of those old things that I found, very tiresome as a child myself, but, I've come to appreciate and see the richness in one of those things that we grew up with that was just you just did it was that if somebody came to visit you and they might not even let you know they were going to visit, they would just be that knock at the door and that was your afternoon. But regardless of the circumstance, that when they left, you walked them out and you walked them to the car and you stood there, and it didn't matter how long it took. And in that same way, same as the corrido, the despedida, that those honored, tried, true traditions were maintained, and that, that there was that continuity, that you knew what to expect. And yes, you did, you know, whatever that version of, you know, taking off your hat or, you know, switching when appropriate to the usted, because it warranted, because this person, you know, required that dignity, right? And a way of caring and conducting yourself. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, I think that Paredes, you know, holds such a significant place in my heart, because he's kind of the other side of the lived experience, you know, the literary, the letters, the putting it and documenting and giving it voice to what I lived and knew as a young man growing up.
Well, thank you both. We're getting close to time to wrap it up. Did any other final thoughts?
Perhaps just to since that Oscar has joined us from representing Brownsville, but South Texas, perhaps this is also a good time to also recognize another great writer from that part of the world, Rolando Hinojosa, who is currently in retirement and quite elderly, but he also has written of the same region in much the same ways. So I just wanted to mention his name. That's all.
Yeah. So also just this incredible presence and kind of a half generation removed from. I mean, they were what, about 15 years difference between them, between Paredes and Hinojosa?
Well, Paredes is born in 1915, Rolando in 1929, so it's almost 14 years.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. 14 years. Yeah. But yeah. Rolando also a retired professor at the University of Texas as well. In fact, for a while there, all three of us overlapped. That is, Oscar, myself, and Rolando.
Oh, wow.
In one English department, by the way.
Yeah. Powerhouse.
We couldn't be on the same floor. Rolando would say, we can't gather. There might be, you know, a bomb might fall and then the whole thing would be wiped out.
Yeah.
Well, Jose, thank you. Oscar, thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you for putting this together, Nate.
Yeah. Oscar, seeing you.
Bye. Yeah, what a treasure to see both of you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. The next episode will air September 29th. If you'd like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, come check it out in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening. And to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.